With the inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th President of the United States of America, the United States is poised to embark on a national course that differs markedly from that of Donald Trump. One topic that has generated considerable interest and speculation is whether the Biden administration will approach China and the U.S.-China relationship in a way that is discernibly different from the preceding administration. With Joe Biden as president, will the United States and China finally begin to move beyond the intense turbulence of the last 4 years? More specifically, what does the future hold for the U.S.-China trade and investment relationship? My name is David Feierstein, and welcome to the Bush China Foundation podcast. Joining me today to explore these questions is Ambassador Ron Kirk, the former United States Trade Representative under President Barack Obama. Ambassador Kirk, thank you so much for joining us.
David, thank you for having me, and it's good to be with you again for a topic that seems like it's ever present and relevant in terms of U.S. foreign affairs.
Ambassador Kirk served as the 16th United States Trade Representative from 2009 to 2013, where he successfully negotiated trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea, as well as Russia's entry into the World Trade Organization. Previously, from 1995 to 2001, he served as the mayor of Dallas, Texas. Ambassador Kirk is currently senior of counsel with the firm Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher and co-chair of the International Trade Practice Group. Ambassador Kirk, you served in the Obama cabinet and you worked very closely with many of the key players now in the Biden administration's foreign policy team. What is your take on the team that President Biden has assembled to advise on and execute the administration's foreign policy and trade policy? And can one fairly interpret Biden's picks for the cabinet and other senior positions as an indication that Biden's approach to the world will look much like President Obama's?
David, I was privileged to serve with a number of members of the new, foreign policy team. As many of them were deputy secretaries or undersecretaries at the State Department, in the case of Tony Blinken and Katherine Tai, was one of our counsels at USTR during my term, and so many. So one, my overall sense is I think the public can be relieved that we are returning to a period of time. And I would say this has been the practice of just about every administration, with the exceptions of the outgoing Trump administration, of picking people with substantive and historical knowledge, experience in the fields in which they have been asked to serve. And given the complexity and the number of challenges that we have ahead of us to both tackle and try to get under control, a health pandemic, the likes of which we have not seen in the last century, turn around our economy, and somehow fashioning a new model to confront an ever-ambitious China. I think this is a team that's well-equipped to do that. I think you will see a lot of similarities in terms of substance and policy between the Biden-Harris administration and the Obama-Biden administration. But I think it would be a disservice to President-elect Biden to just say this is going to be a third term of the Obama administration. President-elect Biden, as we all know, has devoted his life to public service with over 30 years in the Senate. And a substantial part of his tenure in the Senate, he chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So he comes to the job, I think, with his own worldview and his own priorities. And so, I mean, we should not be surprised if we see some differences, even if they are nuanced in terms of his approach to dealing with some of our global challenges than during the Obama administration.
Ambassador Kirk, you noted that President Biden picked trade attorney Katherine Tai to serve as the United States Trade Representative. What do you think this particular choice means for America's approach to trade under the Biden administration? And what do you think her priorities are or should be as she begins her tenure as USTR?
Well, I'll be careful about trying to forecast her priorities because, the job of U.S. Trade Representative, I think for obvious reasons, those who are on the podcast would not be surprised to believe. I think it's one of the most important positions in the cabinet because so much of our economic health as a nation going forward is going to be conditioned on our ability to capture not only the hearts and minds, but the wallets of these new consumers all over the world. Just remember, we are now less than 5% of the world's consumers. Now, thank God, we are spectacularly still the most dynamic and healthy economy in the world. Now, one might argue, of a comment as my father might laugh and say, right now, that's the privilege of being the best house on a bad block. But still, so much of our prosperity in the future is going to be dependent on our ability to capture the business of these new consumers coming of age in China, India, Africa, Brazil, all around the world. So, one, that's important. Secondly, the U.S. Trade Representative's office, if I can just take a minute, is a fairly new position in the cabinet. It was created by statute in the 60s. There have only been now, I guess, Ambassador Tai will be the 18th U.S. Trade Representative. And we come from generally two camps, interestingly enough. There are trade experts who are steeped in the laws and the practices of our trade agreements and the WTO, such as Ambassador Tai will be, having served as not only counsel within USTR, but also as general counsel to the House Ways and Means Committee, which holds jurisdiction over trade matters still. And then you have people like myself and another Texan, former Ambassador Bob Strauss and Senator Rob Portman, who come into the job as businessmen and women and lawyers who have certain political and negotiating skills. So one, I'd say the immediate benefit of Ambassador Tai coming in, she doesn't have to get up to speed on what the issues are. She's been intimately involved in them, and I know we'll talk about it later, David, but say in the case of the renegotiation and modification of NAFTA, she played a very critical role in working with the Trump administration in modernizing that agreement. So from a substantive standpoint, she literally can take the baton and there will be no missteps in terms of the substance. Her challenge will be in getting up comfortable with moving from behind the scenes to the front of the microphone and dealing with the politics of the business. But she will learn that. She will develop her relationship with President Biden and Vice President Harris, the members of the president's economic security team. But I think her immediate priorities will be reassuring our allies, though, our traditional allies around the world, that to the degree we focus our energy on solving trade problems, they will be with countries that have not adhered to the principles of the World Trade Organization, as we think they should, such as China. And we will look to our traditional allies, such as Mexico, Canada, the United Kingdom, Europe, Japan, Australia, and others to work in a collaborative way to address those.
Looking at the U.S.-China trade relationship, and starting with the big picture, how do you assess the Trump administration's record on trade with China over these past 4 years? Do you think the United States is or is not in an overall better place on trade with China than we were in January 2017?
Well, I think that's a complex answer. And I think some might be surprised and think that I would just come and hammer the Trump administration and say they were wrong on everything. I think the biggest failure of the Trump administration was not in misdiagnosing our problem with China, but just over-relying on the blunt instrument of tariffs as the only way to try to get China to change its behavior. And you've heard both President-elect Biden and Vice President Harris speak to this. You heard a number of prominent Republicans speak to it. You know, and our principal objection to the problem with tariffs is that still, notwithstanding the Trump administration continuing to misstate over and over again that China was paying these tariffs, China no more paid for these tariffs than Mexico paid for the wall. And the problem with the tariffs, as we know in particular, our farmers and agricultural producers in the United States have paid the bulk of the burden of that as China has retaliated and frozen the purchase of U.S. agriculture products, which is an area in which we had a very strong and positive trade relationship with China, and also many of our American industries. Say, for example, steel and aluminum as an end product paid a burden for that, particularly our automobile industry. So I don't quarrel with the Trump administration making, I think, a legitimate argument that our past efforts at diplomacy and trying to use the power of a coordinated approach with allies to get China to change its more aberrant behavior needed a more sharpened approach. But I don't think that the tariffs worked. Our trade deficit is still as high as it was. And then I think even more damaging is the Trump administration absolutely alienated most of the allies with whom we had worked to try to confront China, and not only lost the ability to have the strength of that alliance, but in many cases cut ourselves from those markets as well. It is critically important to note that however you may come down on what our approach to China should be, this is not a problem created by the Trump administration. The current Chinese leadership under President Xi in particular has made a radical turn from their commitment to modernizing and opening up their economy to a much more mercantilist approach, one that favors products produced at home by, in many cases, government-owned enterprise or partially owned enterprises. And China has stepped away from at least commitments it made in the past to respect international norms in particular as it relates to protecting intellectual property and not trying to enforce the transfer of critical trade secrets from U.S. and other foreign businesses as the price for doing business in China. So this is not an issue that's easily going to be resolved by a change in leadership in Washington. But I do think an approach that the Biden administration is likely to follow that at least invites to the table again, or at least has the U.S. rejoining efforts of other allied members in the World Trade Organization to confront China, gives us a better chance, if not succeeding, at least halting some of China's progress.
Well, Ambassador Kirk, thank you so much for that. And let me make one point and then follow up with a quick specific question on tariffs, which you just mentioned. The point I want to make is very much consistent with the larger point you just made, is that we at the Bush China Foundation have looked at the numbers, the deficit numbers under the Trump administration, and the numbers are from the Trump administration itself and from the U.S. government. And in fact, the numbers make it very clear that the average annual U.S. merchandise deficit with China during the 4 years of the Trump presidency are actually 10% higher than the average annual merchandise deficit that we had during the presidency of Barack Obama. So on an apples-to-apples basis and on an average annual basis, the Trump administration now has the dubious distinction of having presided over the largest average annual merchandise deficit with China in American history. And so just as you've stated, the policies not only didn't work, they actually exacerbated the problem. But let me ask you this question, Ambassador Kirk.
Before you go, and I know I'm going to make some assumptions. If somebody's willing to listen to a podcast with a couple of trade geeks like you and I, that they're probably, as I'd like to say, part of the trade nerd family. But to the degree that somebody stumbled on this, the numbers you make tell an important story. And the mayor in me always wants to make this as simple. What you basically said is Trump's policy meant that China bought even less from us than they were buying before. And U.S. businesses suffered the burden of having to pay the tariffs. So we had U.S. businesses paying money to satisfy Trump's over-reliance on tariffs while at the same time being closed off from a market that is one that we should want to have access to. And that, I think, was the real failure of this administration.
I couldn't agree more. And just to make one point on that before pivoting to the question on tariffs, you know, the Trump administration found a solution to the problem. The only problem, Ambassador Kirk, was that the solution was worse than the problem. And that's where we ended up after 4 years of these policies. But that leads me to ask you this. Do you think we will see the Biden administration move over the coming weeks or perhaps months to reduce or at least or even do away with the Trump tariffs, given the damage that they have caused to the United States economy?
David, I'm going to sound like a hypocrite, and I hope I do, but I hope it also points out to the listeners that my job as a negotiator is to try to get the best deal we can for the United States. First of all, I don't think you're going to see any immediate move on this, nor should you, as the Biden administration's focus for the first 100 days, the first 3 months, 6 months, however long it takes, is principally going to be laser focused on getting a better system of producing and particularly distributing the vaccine for the coronavirus, as well as getting an economic stimulus in place to try to help working class families that have been hit so hard by the shutdown in economic activity related to this horrible pandemic. So that's going to be one. Secondly, as a negotiator, I wouldn't advise the president to do that, because even as ineffective as these tariffs have been, it is some degree of leverage for the Biden administration. But as inartful and ineffective as they have been, I do think that provides those tariffs being in place have inflicted some pain on China's economy. We can argue perhaps, you know, that pain has been spread equally among American interests that we discussed earlier. But if I were advising the new administration, I would suggest we use the lifting or reduction of those tariffs as negotiating leverage on the issue that really is central to our dispute with China. And that's the attempts to continue to force the transfer of confidential and privileged trade secrets and technology, and see if we can't use that to get more progress on the intellectual property front.
Ambassador Kirk, continuing on the kind of theme of negotiating process, because I think you make some really interesting points, what do you think is the optimal approach for the United States in terms of dealing with China on trade at this juncture? If you could script it, what would a first meeting between the Biden administration and Chinese trade officials look like? What would the agenda be? What substantive or procedural outcomes would be reasonable to expect? And when might such a meeting fruitfully take place?
There are so many conditions on that, as you know. And one, it's just we have to presume that in an evenly divided Senate and perhaps somewhat chastened Republican Senate, given the recent elections, in particular the horrific events of last Wednesday, that Mitch McConnell will work in a collaborative way with the new administration, first of all, to get the president's team in place. In my case, I wasn't sworn in until March, and it just takes a while for, you know, a new team to get in place. There are deputy trade ambassadors who need to be appointed to help. But, you know, I would think that sometimes within the first 6 months, if not sooner, of Catherine Tai being confirmed as ambassador hopefully she would have an opportunity to meet with her colleague from China. Typically, that meeting this early in a term is somewhat perfunctory. They will fill her out for some sense of what the Biden administration will do on tariffs. I think she is uniquely suited to challenge them on their progress, compliance, commitment to the so-called trade deal, you know, phase one and two that the Trump administration worked out. But I don't think that that meeting would be much more than a feeling each other out session, and we shouldn't expect any real substantive progress on that right away. The question is, will the Biden-Harris administration return to the negotiating format that has been used by previous administrations in terms of the strategic and economic dialogue, which is led by the Secretaries of State and Treasury, and then the Joint Commission on Commerce and Trade, which is led by the Secretaries of Commerce and USTR, which allows the two countries to have the opportunity to talk and negotiate regularly and work through these thorny issues. As you know, the Trump administration sort of eschewed those forums. I think they're valuable because the more we sit down at the table, the more we know one another, the more candid we can be. And I do want to assure your listeners, whatever they think of the progress we made, these tend to be extraordinarily candid sessions in which not only the U.S. trade representatives, but the secretaries of commerce and state and treasury and even the secretary of defense all make it plain to China what parts of their economic policy that we find so objectionable and their behavior and what we expect from them in order to be able to move forward. But again, the difficulty, as I noted, and it has to be underscored, is that we have, for the first time in, you know, the last 10 to 15 years, a Chinese administration who seems to, if not have abandoned their ambition to become a market-based economy, certainly that is not as high on their list of priorities as it was before.
Let me ask you, Ambassador Kirk, about Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA. It's set to expire on July 1st of this year. If memory serves, this important authority was not in effect during your tenure as USTR during the Obama administration. Can you share with our listeners why TPA matters and the degree to which TPA's impending lapse will or won't affect U.S. trade negotiations with China, and for that matter, other countries?
Well, it is very important, David, and we did have Trade Promotion Authority during my administration. Now, there were some that argued that we shouldn't have, but if you will recall, and you noted in my introduction, we were able to conclude and get congressional approval of three trade agreements that we inherited with Colombia, Panama, and Korea, as well as launch potential trade agreements with the European Union and the now, in effect, Trans-Pacific Partnership minus the United States. For your listeners, Trade Promotion Authority is a legislative vehicle that was created to facilitate the negotiation and approval of trade agreements with other countries who were concerned that because our Constitution grants final authority over trade, international trade agreements, it kept that with the Congress. Other countries didn't want to negotiate with the president or our trade negotiator for fear they would make all of these commitments and then send those agreements to Congress, and Congress would say, no, we don't like it, go back, change this, change that, which could create problems for them back home, but also lead to a never-ending series of amendments. So we created this process whereby before the administration can negotiate a trade agreement, we have to go to Congress and say, we'd like to, for example, negotiate a trade agreement with the European Union. And we sort of pre-negotiate ahead with Congress through our committees of jurisdiction, the House Ways and Means and Senate Finance Committees, and they say, here's what you're going to do. And this is somewhat formulaic. The purpose of every trade agreement is basically as close to 100% tariff reduction on goods, services, agriculture, making sure we all play by the same rules, agreeing on certain labor now, environmental standards and others. So all of that's pre-approved. And then Congress grants the administration, the president, through the USTR, sort of pre-scripted authority to go try to negotiate an agreement within those parameters. For that flexibility to negotiate in those terms, the agreement is that once the trade agreement is concluded and the administration submits it to Congress, they have to then vote it up or down. They can't come back and say, change this or that. And that incentivizes these other countries to frankly sit down and negotiate with us in full faith. The net effect of it is if we don't have that trade promotion authority, it's a signal to the rest of the world that the United States is on the sidelines. The reality is the rest of the world doesn't stand still, David. And so in this case, when you have a Trump administration that very much favored a bilateral approach, just negotiating one country at a time versus larger agreements with the world, the rest of the world has moved on. I mentioned the Trump administration immediately withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That is now the largest, most progressive, modernized trade agreement in the world, largely drafted under terms favorable to the United States, and we're now on the sidelines. And people ask me, well, what's the import of that? And I hate it, but again, the mayor and me said the simplest example I can give you, if you imagine those of you who love to travel, going, you know, to an airport, and there's the largest duty-free trade zone in the world that the United States has built, and then decided everyone else can shop there duty-free except for the United States. That puts us at a hell of a competitive disadvantage.
Given your earlier service as mayor of Dallas, let me ask you one Texas-specific question. Where do you sense that Texas corporate sentiment is on China today? Are Texas-based companies, which represent a very disproportionate share of America's largest and most successful companies, supportive of advancing the commercial relationship with China? And more generally, how does public sentiment, in your experience, particularly in your experience as USTR, bear on the sort of corporate mindset about engaging with China on trade?
Well, David, I want to be careful because I am a director for a number of public companies, and so I want to make it plain. I'm speaking in my role as Ron Kirk, former trade ambassador, not on behalf of any particular corporate company. So I would say broadly, when you're talking about the state of Texas, no state benefits more from our global trade engagements than the state of Texas. We are far and away the largest beneficiary in terms of goods sold to the rest of the world. Some of that's because of the strength of our oil and based economy, but much more it's because Texas is one of the leading states in technology. So we export as much as any other state around the world. David, I want to say close to 20-25% of our jobs in the state of Texas are linked to international trade. So I would say broadly, I think as dangerous as it is to try to speak for corporate Texas writ large, but generally the corporations in this state are ones that are global in nature, very supportive of our engagement of the world. But depending on the companies, they are also sober about the challenges of dealing with China, but still see it as potentially a win-win solution based on the fact there's 1.5 billion Chinese, that China is determined to move into a more modern lifestyle, and the knowledge China can't do it alone. And that if we can solve this riddle of how to work collaboratively, China represents a huge, huge market for Texas exporters, both agriculture, manufacture, technology, energy, and others.
Well, Ambassador Kirk, I think that's really well said. And let me just add two quick data points that completely support what you've just said. Number one, in 2019, Texas actually surpassed California and became the number one U.S. state exporter to China. And that was quite a milestone, particularly for us Texans, Ambassador Kirk. And secondly, overall, Texas exports to the world about $1 billion a day. It's approximately $365 billion a year in exports, which, just as you rightly noted, really undergirds the extraordinary economic performance of the state of Texas. And hopefully we will see that continue for Texas and for all U.S. states as we go forward. One last very quick question, and it's a big topic, but just to get at least a brief thought from you, Ambassador Kirk, before we conclude. And that is, as you very well know, technology, the issue of technology and the technology competition has become a vastly more contentious issue in the U.S.-China relationship over the last several years. Where do you see the issue of technology as an issue in U.S.-China relations going over the next couple of years?
David, I think, and I want to be careful because we are from Texas, is such a large state. We are an important player in the energy industry. We are still one of the most successful agricultural exporters in everything from cotton and cattle and beef and grains for our farmers and ranchers. But if you look at the overall health of the U.S. economy, even though we are becoming much more of a service-based economy, our economic future is tied to our creativity and our ingenuity. For you and I and most of the people on this call, we've grown up and watched our nation become an international powerhouse because of changes as we move from a farm-based economy to one on the factory. And then the assembly line began to give way to automation. Now that's giving way to different changes in technology and now artificial intelligence. And one of the benefits of trade is shifting production assembly to those countries that have the workers to be able to do that. And some of that is going to happen organically, whether we have a trade agreement or not. But if we cannot reap the benefits of our creativity, of all of these brilliant young minds coming out of our incredible network of colleges and universities from California to Texas to Massachusetts to New York and in between, then our economic future looks very different. And we cannot allow a country as China, as noble and as committed as they are to make their own transition from an agrarian society to one more dependent on consumption and production and manufacturing. We cannot allow them to do that by skipping a step, by appropriating the work product of our creativity. You know, as a kid, we were always taught that imitation was the sincerest form of flattery. But as I like to tell people, when it comes to taking your work product and appropriating it for your own benefit, that's theft. And that is the core and the crux of our challenge with China. And I would say some other emerging economies, as they're trying to short circuit that process of advancing their economies by appropriating U.S. trade secrets and technology any way that they can. And it's our collective responsibility, but certainly those of our government leaders to make sure that we do everything we can to protect that. If we can somehow get China to recognize that the only way they're going to create a knowledge-based economy of their own is to respect and protect intellectual property so that they have their own Chinese investors and entrepreneurs building an economy that is sustainable. If we can get China to do that, then we have the opportunity for a very bright and collaborative relationship. But if we cannot, we have to be very sober about what that means and be willing to tell China that we just will not allow them to have access to the rest of the world's markets if they aren't going to compete on the same terms as our businesses have to.
Well, I think that's really well said, Ambassador Kirk. And I think we are at a truly pivotal moment for the U.S.-China relationship, and more specifically, the U.S.-China trade and investment relationship. And it's going to be very interesting to see how things unfold over the coming days, weeks, and months. Ambassador Kirk, thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your perspectives on such a wide range of U.S.-China trade issues.
Thank you all for always giving me a home and a voice. And David, it's always good to be with you.
Thank you so much, sir. And to our audience, let me just say, remember to look for our Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can follow all our conversations. Thank you for listening.